Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Mags. Over the next 30 minutes, I'll bring you the latest headlines from South Africa and around the globe. Whether you're tuning in live or catching the podcast later, stay with us for in-depth conversation with leading business minds, political influencers, and key newsmakers. It's everything you need to stay informed, quick, sharp, and straight to the point. It's Friday, the 1st of November. On our program today, does the Finance Minister's midterm budget pump sufficient blood into the country's transport arteries? How a new digital approach could see better maintenance of road infrastructure? With kidnappings on the rise, is it time to reconsider insurance cover? And how the massive and growing US debt pile might influence South Africa? Up first, and I want to take a critical look quickly at South Africa's logistics and transport infrastructure difficulties, and it's all underscored by a response from the Road Freight Association following the medium-term budget policy statement. Gavin Kelly is the Chief Executive Officer of the Road Freight Association and is going to join me now to discuss how new budget allocations, or lack thereof, may impact the country's economic growth, social development, and international competitiveness. So Gavin, good afternoon. Let's start with this. The big picture is that the Transport Ministry is claiming it's the heartbeat of South Africa's economic growth. That's a direct quote. Do you believe the budget prioritization actually reflects that sentiment?
I don't see that at all. There were two very, very vague references to public transport and in terms of the ETOLs, and that's a whole different discussion. But in terms of the critical aspects, and there's a presidential national logistics crisis committee, I don't see that commitment. I don't see any really tangible projects and timelines to address the challenges we have.
And if that's the case, Gavin Kelly, what does that actually mean in terms of impact?
Well, that means we're going to just keep going backwards in terms of being competitive with the countries around us. We know that the Angolas and the Mozambiques of the world are upgrading their ports, even Namibia. We know that shipping lines are thinking twice in terms of where they would stop off to drop off containers. And that means that our facilities will keep going backwards in terms of modernization. The equipment deficiencies that we have, we're going to struggle with. We know that in the port of Durban, we need a lot more cranes. We need better maintenance. So we're just going to go backwards.
Do you see then any feasible path forward within these budget constraints at all?
Well, I would have thought that the Minister of Finance would have laid a path in terms of what a public-private partnership would be, would have made very clear indication of where they want to enter into these, what sort of role they saw private sector playing. And there's always the specter that private sector will take out government and then make huge profits. Made a number of very clear determinations as where and how private sector gets involved, what their responsibility would be, and probably have put down a 5-year, at least perhaps a 3-year funding program saying, this is what we are going to dedicate towards the harvest, for example, or rail, and this is what we want private sector to do to achieve the following.
So, Gavin, what do you think the main hurdles are preventing private investment in infrastructure right now? And what's the immediate step then that that government needs to take?
I think there are hurdles on either side of that divide. On the private sector side, I think we're all cautious. We're worried about putting in huge amounts of funding that'll disappear. There'll be no proper control. Private sector will lose control of that funding, and there won't be anybody held responsible. I think that's what we've seen, the type of scenarios we've seen in the last couple of years. From the government side, I think there's a lot of pressure from union side, but from other entities within government, that government is going to sell off assets, no longer have control of this. There's the fear that there's going to be huge employment losses, which is not true. So I think there's a fair amount of mistrust on either side. What needs to happen is that we need to agree to a defined goal, an objective. Then we need to agree how either side is going to play in that and who's going to hold whoever accountable and what would happen if you didn't play the ball that you needed to play.
So what, in your opinion, or in your sector's opinion, is that clear goal or objective?
Well, I think, first of all, we need to get the ports up and running. So the ports, for example, need to be able to compete with the best in the world. That would be the objective. Because from there, you can build a number of stepping stones or waypoints. So we need to get A, equipment, and B, facilities, and C, technological input, and we need this sort of workforce, we need that sort of funding, this is who's going to bring it in, that lot will be responsible for this. You could map that out very clearly, but we need a very clear time frame and make sure that we meet those waypoints.
The critics would say that we've run out of time.
Well, I don't disagree with that, Jeremy. I think we ran out of time a couple of years ago. That is why it is so urgent. That's why I've said we need these stents in the arteries of the transport, you know, arteries of South Africa. We are actually now, we are faced with having to better the ports around us, not just equal them. So yes, time is really of the essence.
And Gavin Kelly, you also spoke about consequence management in this respect. If targets and goals and objectives are not met, how punitive do we need to get here?
Well, punitive is an interesting term. One of the things would be that you would want to change that entity responsible or providing the service. So that would be one thing. Around the world, there are financial penalties. One has to make sure that that doesn't destroy the whole project on its own and sabotage doesn't play a role. But the thing is, we haven't held entities accountable for what they are supposed to do. This is money coming from you and I. There's no such thing as government funding. It's public money. We need to hold those who have been entrusted with spending the public money, looking at providing services to the citizens, accountable for what they do and to deal with them quickly and effectively.
And finally, Gavin, you represent an incredibly influential organization within the supply chain in South Africa. What is the freight or the Road Freight Association's next move?
Well, I think we'll always be here to support the important key modes within the logistics supply chain. So we are not anti-rail, we're not anti-port, and it will always be the association and a lot of its large members play in those spheres, trying to push that we become the logistics hub that we need to be in the world and supporting those initiatives that are going to make the changes for the citizens of South Africa and those supply chain players.
Gavin Kelly, thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, on a similar theme, I don't need to tell you that South Africa's roads have long been in need of repair, but there is talk now of a potential game changer when it comes to road management. And I'm in conversation now with the Director of Asset Management at Zutari. It's an infrastructure engineering and advisory practice, Dr. Chris van Holt, who is going to discuss the implications for these new proposals for road repair and what it broadly means for South Africa's infrastructure future. You heard Gavin Kelly from the Road Freight Association talking about the critical urgency to get infrastructure up and running a lot better than it is right now. So, Dr. van Holt, welcome. And maybe, first of all, can you outline for me what makes this proposal this potential game changer and how does it differ from previous road maintenance strategies?
Hi, Jeremy. Thanks for having me and really pleased to find a money guy like you interested in maintenance. So, maintenance itself is not new. It's been around for a long time, but what the Mpumalanga maintenance management system is really about is changing the way that the department, as in our Department of Public Works and Transport in Mpumalanga, is shifting from being a paper-based, process-oriented organization with very cumbersome processes to a very new digital way of working, the streamlined process. So what this essentially means is less paper, streamlined admin, and then also better information to make decisions and to control their operations. So it used to be just about impossible to know across the entire Mpumalanga network of 13,000 kilometers, kind of where the potholes are, where the maintenance teams are, how much good work has been done every week, and how well the resources are being used. And this is all changing. So the department can now see what's happening across 28 different cost centers across the province, and are much better informed about the reality on the ground. So this is quite a significant shift for them.
All right, Chris, I'd be letting the side down then if I didn't ask you the money question. And I think it's fair to say that funding and implementation are often hurdles in any big projects, such as the ones that you're mentioning. So what do we know about the funding model? How feasible is it in terms of getting quick impact?
Well, I think what we know is that there's a limited amount of money available to the province. And I mean, I think everybody realizes the state that our national road system finds it in with all the potholes that we see across the country. I think what's important to understand, yeah, is that you really need to be doing two things. There's, you need to keep the good roads good, and then also deal with the potholes as a kind of arise on our network. I think our network is aging and we haven't been doing enough preventative maintenance. There's this old saying that, you know, stitch in time saves nine. And to a large degree, we have ignored this philosophy. And now we have a road network that has deteriorated over time. So we have a real challenge on our hands. And I think this is why the department is looking at, within their available funding, how do they optimize that expenditure? How do they get the best impact they can with the money they have? Mm. And, you know, being inefficient is just not good enough anymore. We're facing a massive problem with these potholes. And the war against potholes is a war that is not easily won. And it's, to be honest, it's quite easily lost. So you need to be better organized as a business to actually tackle this problem.
All right, let's talk a little bit about the private sector as far as this is concerned. Ideally, what role should it be playing in the initiative? And I guess it all comes down to government creating a better and more attractive investment environment.
So I think the private sector obviously expects a transport system that works effectively. I think what the Mpumalanga department are now doing is trying to invite individuals to actually contribute to the identification of issues on their road network. And with this maintenance management system, they've actually launched, we're just launching now, a web app. And it's a website address, the www.potholes.org.za. From a name, it kind of unfortunately sounds like the potholes are organized against us, but I suppose it is a bit of our reality. But I think the department is really inviting individuals now out their businesses to log the problems, get them that information. It's now makes its way to the department. In the past, people would maybe report issues, but you never know whether those issues are lost, whether anyone's actually doing anything about it, and you get no feedback. And they've really changed that. So you can log an issue on that you identify, like a pothole. You can take a photograph. You zoom in on this web app on a map, and it gives the exact location. And that information all goes to the department, and what they then do, they issue a reference number that you can go back to. But it also goes into the planning and prioritization process. So they got that data. It helps them prioritize. You can't really expect that, you know, they're going to fix your pothole next and necessarily next week, but you can be sure it's in the process. And it will be prioritized. So and those issues that are logged that are not dealt with within a month will be escalated to a higher level in the department, and they've got visibility of that. And then once the work's scheduled, you get an email that the work's been scheduled, and once the repair's been made, you get another email that the repair is fixed, and you can then know, you know, your problem you raised has been done. So the department's trying to improve that communication with the private sector, with communities out there, trying to be more responsive and also get better information for them to work more efficiently.
I'm sensing a lot of moving parts as far as a project like this is concerned. And again, it's critical that measures then would need to be in place to ensure that the plan is both effective, as you've outlined, but also free from corruption.
Yeah, sure. I think there's, you know, there's corruption and there's inefficiency. And then you also got, Jeremy, got, you know, just poor planning. And all these things kind of prevent you from winning the war against, maintenance problems and potholes. And I think what the system we've now developed and what's different is that you now have got really good information about what's going on. And you've got information about how productive your teams are. You've got information about how much fuel is being used, how much inventory is being used. And just that visibility of information suddenly, makes the entire business a lot more transparent. And not only you can make better decisions, but you also have better management control over what's going on. Mm.
And very quickly, Chris, if this works in Mpumalanga, obviously it's a blueprint for the rest of the country.
Yeah, I think absolutely. I think, Mpumalanga, we've been supporting them as Utari since 2015 on this. So it's been a project that's underway for quite a while, and they've kind of walked the long road. But I think as a blueprint, the other provinces can quite easily leverage the software, the field apps, the processes, all that belongs to the state. It all belongs to the province. Mm. And it can really accelerate the improvement of maintenance in the other provinces that need it. So, I think that's good for the country.
Indeed. All we want to do is not necessarily walk the long road, but drive the long road pothole free. Chris van Holt, thank you very much indeed. He is the Director of Asset Management at Zutari, as I said a little earlier, an infrastructure engineering and advisory practice.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, with kidnapping for ransom escalating to crisis levels in South Africa, and I think that's a fair statement, particularly here in Gauteng, individuals and businesses alike are increasingly vulnerable. Joining me now is Richard Hood, Chief Executive Officer of the Broking House Olea Africa, to discuss the risk landscape and key impacts and how people can better protect themselves with new and perhaps specialized coverage. So, Richard, welcome. And first of all, then, what factors, in your opinion, are driving the surge in abductions for ransom in this country?
Well, I think it's just the typical crime that we witness in South Africa. It's on the rise, isn't it, Jeremy? So I think this is a more of an opportunistic thing. I think this is a crime that wasn't particularly well known in South Africa. That's becoming well known as the media is reporting on it. It's something that probably floated a little bit under the radar for many, many years. Often these cases aren't reported because people want to keep things confidential. So I think it's probably always been there, but not well publicized. And obviously there's been some high profile cases over the last, say, year or so, which has really brought this into the spotlight now. But I think it's obviously the prevailing economic conditions of South Africa, unemployment, etc. And it's probably one of the easier crimes to commit, I would say, if I had to put my criminal hat on.
And no real surprise, Richard, that Gauteng has become the epicenter.
Correct. Although we've had cases both in the Eastern Cape as well and in KZN as well. But of course, Gauteng being the economic hub of South Africa, that's an obvious target area for these criminal syndicates and gangs to operate. So yes, but it is spread pretty much across South Africa. We haven't seen too much in the Western Cape, as it turns out. But certainly Eastern Cape, Natal and Gauteng are the prominent areas.
Explain to me why it's a fairly easy crime to commit.
I think because it probably doesn't necessarily require the use of extreme violence. It's fairly well contained. It doesn't entail, gangs going into shopping centres and holding people up and using extreme force. I think it can be quite speculative. So, and you're targeting one individual rather than, and typically an individual that might not be secured or protected. So I think it's just a crime that's easier to commit, I would say.
And it's not just high net worth individuals, if I understand this correctly. So what specific factors, if they in fact exist, would make someone a potential target?
We've seen cases involving, senior executives, in business to, even the smaller cases, when I say smaller cases, cases where the demands aren't as severe or as much as what one would expect for, a senior executive in a business. So it is. There's 15,000 incidents that were reported to the SAPS at the end of 2023. So These aren't just senior executives. These are people spread across the spectrum. So we've even seen certain cases in rural areas where literally people will be kidnapped and a ransom of, R1,000 requested. So it is broad based across the country, involving different tiers of people.
And this is what you mean, or what would be called an express kidnapping, where it's in and out and the ransom is low?
No, express kidnapping is a term that's now been used widely. where someone is kidnapped, held against their will, and basically their bank accounts are drained. In other words, when you're kidnapped, they have access to your cell phone, where they can gain access to your banking profiles. They have access to your credit cards, and they will hold you hostage for a period of time whilst they effectively drain your bank accounts whilst they're holding you hostage. And normally the incident ends, sadly, when all the accounts have been drained and the person is then released.
So let's talk a little bit about mitigation now. Kidnap for ransom insurance. What key benefit would a policy like that provide, and why should a person consider taking it?
Well, interestingly enough, we never used to see much demand for these type of insurance products until recently. These are products, insurance products, that were typically reserved for companies that deployed their staff into foreign territories which were deemed as high risks, you know, South America, for example, Central America, Central Africa. So what we see now is that there's certainly, because this is more publicized, people are looking at insurance to perhaps provide, as you call it, a risk mitigation, you know, to this risk. So basically it provides fairly comprehensive insurance coverage, you know, for a range of expenses associated with the kidnapping incident itself, including the ransom payments, negotiation costs, medical care, crisis management services. So it is pretty broad-based what the cover provides. It also importantly provides expert assistance, which is the insurer actually provides themselves. And these are basically giving people access to trained professionals who can provide guidance and support throughout a particular incident, from initial response and negotiation. And most importantly, to try and secure the safe release of the victim.
And obviously the psychological toll is immense as well, so critical that the after effects are properly managed as well.
100%. I mean, the real goal of this insurance policy is really to ensure the safe release of the victim, and importantly deal with any collateral damage to the family, to the businesses that may be involved. So the cover is pretty comprehensive in terms of what it provides.
So just finally then, Richard, are there any immediate proactive steps that a person or a company can take to assess, first of all, and then mitigate exposure?
I think there's some fairly obvious ones. Often a lot of us are on social media, and it doesn't take a criminal too long to work out who the senior people in certain organizations are. So maybe adopting perhaps a low profile. Sometimes that's very difficult in the modern day and age, adopting a low profile. With insurance solutions does come the ability to access resources that the insurers can provide of possessing, you know, high-risk territories, guiding companies in terms of how to mitigate the risk from a practical sense. But it is a difficult one, as I say. It's very difficult to protect individuals, you know, 24/7. That's normally reserved for, you know, high-profile people of the state, typically. So it is a difficult one to mitigate against.
Richard Hood, thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
And finally on our program, with the US election now 3 days away, one issue remains conspicuously absent from the campaign trail. It's the government's deficit. Flagship asset fund manager Philip Short is now asking why this growing fiscal burden, and listen to this number, 125% of GDP, is not on everybody's radar. Both parties, he goes on to say, have contributed to this massive debt pile, but neither is addressing it openly, despite projections that plans from both sides could add trillions to the entire deficit over the next decade or so. Philip, welcome. Thank you very much for joining me. And first off, explain to me then why this deficit has grown so drastically in recent years, and who really does bear primary responsibility?
It's difficult to say who's primarily responsible because, as you mentioned, both parties have contributed quite meaningfully to it. The last budget surplus was in 2001 under Bill Clinton, and since then, every single year has been a budget deficit. And the reason why this is a problem is that deficits are funded by debt. So the government, every time they have a budget deficit, they fund that by issuing more government debt. So as you can imagine, if you've had a deficit since 2001, and some of them have been quite significant during COVID and the great financial crisis, is that is the main reason why US government debt is sitting at the odd $35 trillion.
So if we have a deficit of 125% of GDP in the United States, maybe just give me a sense of what the short-term risks are that this poses to the American economy?
The number one issue with this 125% number of GDP is that it indicates that the debt is not being used productively. So this ratio from the 1980s was probably sitting at about 70 or 80% of GDP, and it's now sitting at 125% of GDP. And the U.S.'s own Congressional Budget Office expects this to hit 200% in the next 30 years. The short-term risks is that this indicates to the market that the fiscal situation of the U.S. is unsustainable, and that makes borrowing costs, as people decide, okay, can I trust the U.S. government to get its debt house in order, that the borrowing costs of U.S. debt starts going higher. Debt costs going higher is inflationary, and that will be negative for most financial markets.
And this is a massive economy, and there are ramifications, as I mentioned at the start of our conversation, for all other countries. Let's get there in just a moment. But first of all, you talk about the debt not being used productively. Explain that to me.
So the reason why we look at debt to GDP as a ratio is that if you, for example, can borrow $100 and you invest it in the economy, which is represented by your GDP, you want your GDP to grow by at least the amount that you've borrowed the money amount. So if I borrowed $100 in an effective economy or productive economy, I want my GDP to grow by at least the same amount. If the GDP does grow by more than the amount I've borrowed, then that ratio comes down as your denominator gets larger than your numerator. So that's why we look at this ratio. And the fact that if you build a highway and you're charging people to ride over that highway and you're making money from that, then you can afford to borrow more money and build more highways. And so your economy becomes more productive. This has not been the case with the U.S., as we can see from the rising debt to GDP number.
And the concern here, or the solution, would be to perhaps start looking at fiscal austerity. But in an election cycle, this is something that no politician, whether it's in the United States of America or anywhere else, is going to go near.
Yes, and I think this is probably the main point for us, and I think for listeners to, if I could highlight one thing, it's this. It is that the interest bill, the U.S. interest bill for the government has gotten so large that the U.S. government is at the point now where they are borrowing money, more money, just to pay the current interest bill, not the principal. Put it into relatable terms, as if me and you had a credit card and we had maxed out that credit card, and we now have to get a second credit card just to pay off the interest on the first credit card. So that is why, with some sort of confidence, say that deficits will continue in the foreseeable future, because they need to raise more debt just to pay for the interest on the current debt.
Am I over-amplifying this when I say that there are shades here of the 2008 financial crisis, which we all know ended very badly?
No, I don't think they're comparable. So the one was more in the general economy. So looking at 2008, and that was the general economy, and that's when there were junk assets and liquidity dried up, because none of the banks wanted to borrow money or sell money or buy money or any assets from the other banks, because they weren't sure of the assets or the quality of the assets that the other banks were selling to them. So then the whole economy dried up because there was no liquidity. No one wanted to lend money to anyone. And that's when the government or the Fed came in and flooded the market with money. Here you got the issue where the government is just spending too much money. And if they wanted to, they could carry on printing more money, but that would ultimately be inflationary. So the one was a liquidity problem, and here this becomes 2008 was a liquidity problem. And here we've got more problem of credibility, the US credibility.
And if that's the case, then what are the potential consequences for investors, particularly if this deficit trend continues unchecked?
So what I like to say to myself is that the US can never default. So that, you know, sort of problem with the US defaulting, it's because they can always print more money, because all their debt is in dollars. But if they keep on printing money, you're going to have long-term bonds, so 10-year treasuries, which we've already seen now in the last couple of weeks go from 3.6 to about 4.2%. You're going to see yields go high on long-term bonds, which means that it's more expensive for people and governments themselves, or the US itself, to borrow money. Now, all else being equal, if borrowing costs go higher, this is inflationary. And in that environment, when you've got high inflation and high long-term bond yields, you've got equities and bonds that will suffer. And you'll have things like real-world hard assets, such as gold and other commodities, doing better in such environments.
And Philip, just a quick one, please. What's the worst case scenario here in terms of getting this under control, Trump or Harris?
The projections, looking at their own explicit statements in terms of what they want to spend, what tax cuts they do or don't want to do point that the deficit is going to be higher under Trump. But there is the caveat, and it's, you know, the one thing that you can do is if you can get the economy to grow really, really well, if you can get that GDP number up relative to the debt issuance, then that would be a plus. So from a pure deficit point of view, it looks like it's more negative under a Trump administration. But to be honest with you, I'm not sure in terms of who is better to get that GDP number up.
Well, as I said at the start of this conversation, less than a week to go. And as you've heard from Philip Short from Flagship Asset Management, the stakes are incredibly high. Philip, thank you very much indeed. I appreciate your time. And that is our program for today and for the week. MoneyWeb at Midday is live at noon weekdays. We are then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening. And goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.